My name is Debo Powers, and today is November 3rd, 2012. I'm interviewing for the first time Richard Hillner. This interview is taking place at 350 Moose Creek Road, Polebridge, Montana. This interview is sponsored by the North Fork Landowners Association and is part of the North Fork History Project. So Richard, tell us a little about your early background, where you were born and...
Well, I was born in Jacksonville, Illinois, and I came to the North Fork in 1958 as a 12-year-old boy. And I came with the Foremans, Helen and Orville Foreman. Their children were grown, and I think they needed and wanted somebody to help chop wood and split kindling and do errands and things around the place. And I was steeped in North Fork lore long before I came to the North Fork, and that's how I got here as their guest, really.
Lucky for you. Lucky for the North Fork, too. What are some of, when you first came as a 12-year-old boy, what were some of your earliest memories?
My first memories were that we stopped. Helen Foreman had a blue three-ring notebook, and we drove out from Illinois, and in the last 24 hours of the driving, I suppose, or the last day of driving, Helen pulled out her North Fork notebook and began going through the checklist and putting together the grocery list of what we needed for 1 week of groceries and any supplies that we might need. And I remember going to the B&B grocery in Kalispell, picking up those groceries, and it included a slab of bacon, a whole side of bacon, uncut, with the rind still on it. And I thought, wow, I've never seen one of these before. And we had no refrigeration in those days at the Foreman's Ranch, which is called the Sawtooth Ranch. And Orville would, in the morning, send me down into the root cellar of the original homestead cabin, Emil Peterson's homestead cabin, and I'd pull down a cloth flour sack in which this slab of bacon would hang, and I'd bring it up, and Orville would figure out how many people had to be fed, and he would slice off that many slices of side bacon, and then he always saved a piece of the rind that had some fat on it to grease the griddle for his pancakes. And he was always very proud of his pancakes. He always made breakfast up here. And so that was one of my early memories. And the other thing I remember is one day I went down and I pulled down this sack and I brought the bacon up and it had some mold on it. And I said, oh, it's all moldy. And Helen said, that's not a problem. And she grabbed that bacon and she slathered it with vinegar and scrubbed it with a brush. And it was as good as new. And we had fresh bacon. And that's the way it was.
Well, I bet your life up in the North Fork was really different from where you lived the rest of the year. What were the differences?
Well, I came to the mountains. Illinois is as flat as one of Orville Foreman's pancakes. And you could see into the next century or back to the last one from Illinois and that part of Illinois, central Illinois. And to come to the mountains, and as a 12-year-old, I'd already been reading about Daniel Boone and all those sorts of characters, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a mountain man, and I wanted to live in the woods. And when we got here, the whole process was you had to set up camp. In other words, you had to get the place operational, and that required several days. And the water pump from the spring seemed like it never worked the first time. And it required trips up and down the hill to find out where the leaks were in the pipes and why the pump wasn't pumping and who'd lost the prime and one thing after another. And this went on for days. And every day I would bug Orville and I'd say, Uncle Orville, and they had asked me to start calling him Aunt and Uncle. So it was Uncle Orville and Aunt Helen from that year on. But I would bug Orville every day. I said, so when are we going trout fishing? When are we going trout fishing? And he would say, after we get things set up, after we get the electricity, after we get the water, after this and after that. And I would kept saying, when are we going fishing? And about the third or fourth day we were here, we had to go down. Their cabin is up on the bench, and the homestead cabin was on the bench. And we had to go down as a quarter, half mile to the river. And it's a steep climb down into there, the river doesn't cross there anymore, but Orville said the river came up against a log jam, and he said, throw a fly right out there. And I threw a fly out there. I'd never fly fished before. I threw the fly out there. Fish came roaring out of there and went right over the top of my fly, and I screamed and hooted and hollered and missed it. And that happened in succession, time after time. And Orville was beside himself with laughter. I think I gave him as much joy watching me miss fish. I don't miss as many now as I did then. But that was an early time. And when the pump didn't work, what we had to do was we would take... Well, Orville called them GI cans, but they were garbage cans. And we would load two garbage cans in the back of the Jeep, and we'd drive down to the Trail Creek Bridge. And we'd stop at the bridge and throw a bucket over the edge of the bridge into the creek. And then we'd haul the bucket up and pour buckets of water into these big garbage cans, and then haul the water. And that's what we had for drinking water until we got the pump going.
Wow.
That was those early memories. It was such wild country. Oh, it was wild, wild country. And the road was just a narrow. It was dirt from the time you crossed the railroad tracks. You didn't go over the railroad tracks in Columbia Falls. You crossed the railroad tracks in Columbia Falls and headed north, and that's where the pavement ended and the dirt started, and it was narrow and windy and just a great, wild place.
It's great. Well, did you know any of the original homesteaders?
Yeah, I did, actually. I knew the Harry and Lena Holcomb. Many people called them Ma and Pa Holcomb. They were one of my first and earliest memories of the homesteaders. The Wirts were still on their property when I arrived. Ollie and Madge Ollie Tarian, they were still there, though Ollie wasn't a homesteader. He certainly had built his reputation, and it was well deserved and earned, I think, as was Madge's. And Ralph and Esther Day were still here. Early on, Ralph had brought the mail. He brought the mail over from Belton, from West Glacier, and he brought it through the old inside road to Polebridge, and then he drove it north from Polebridge and delivered the mail. Ted Ross had the store, and Fred Boss drove the mail when I was here. And the mail was, well, as it is even today, mail day is an exciting day. And for us, it was to drive out to the mailbox. It's about a mile from the foreman's place out to the road. And we would often try to be there to meet the mail. And while we waited for the mail, Helen would be busy writing notes and letters to people and making sure that they got in the mail. And then Fred would come by, and we'd have a little conversation. And oftentimes what we would do would leave a shopping list for him, some things that we really needed, like fresh milk. And then he'd go shopping. You'd give him a brief shopping list, and he'd shop for everybody up and down the North Fork. And you wanted to be there when he delivered the next time, because if you didn't, you didn't want the fresh food sitting there for the bears. But that was what I remember. It was always that conversation. And then Helen would quickly tear into the mail before she left the mailbox to see if there was anything that urgently had to be addressed before driving the mail back to the cabin.
That's great. Well, you got a big grin on your face when you talked about Ollie and Madge. And do you know stories about them? Or?
Well, yeah, I do, actually. You were at dinner the other night when I was telling about Madge and her Pontiac automobile, and that she had, they lived on the border, as I think most people know, and she had gone to town, and as she recounted the story, that she had gone to town to, because she had to get some chickens, and live chickens, and she also needed to get some parts, and so the Pontiac, the place she said she always got parts was the junkyard. That's because you could find more Pontiacs in the junkyard than you could at the dealership. So she had gone to town and was returning late in the evening, and Madge was only about 4 feet 10 inches tall, maybe 4'11", but certainly well under 5 feet. And when you saw Madge coming down the road in one of those Pontiac automobiles, you weren't sure if there was anybody driving because she couldn't see over the steering wheel. She looked through the steering wheel. And what had happened on this occasion was that she was approaching her place, and she had to come around, and it was a hairpin turn coming into Colts Creek. Came down the hall, the hill, and made a right-hand turn around in that sharp bend. And she said she lost her steering and went just right down into Colts Creek. And when she went right down into Colts Creek, of course, the chickens all escaped, and she just left it right there in the creek, the Pontiac. And she walked back and told Ollie what had happened, and they decided nothing could happen until morning. And so the next morning they came back, and sure enough, the Pontiac was still there, and the chickens were still roosting in the back of the back of the car. But she was diminutive in her height, but not diminutive in her stature, if you understand what I mean. Because yeah, she had this penetrating look. She had for a 12-year-old boy, 13, you know, those early years, she was somebody. I sometimes felt a little frightened of her because I'd never met anybody quite like her. She wore men's clothing. She wore these shirts and boots and flannel shirts and Ollie was probably 5 feet 8 inches tall. Wiry. I mean, wiry would describe Ollie. And I remember that he wasn't strong as somebody who's been lifting weights half their life, but I remember his biceps were just these big, huge bulges right there on his arm. And he had this awful dog. He had the meanest dog I have ever known. His name was Cola. And it was a black German Shepherd, and it was crossed with mean. And I had to, every once in a while, ride with Ollie, because we were, for part of one summer, we picked rock up Trail Creek, up above Tuchuk, for the foreman's fireplace, because they were building a new, larger cabin. And when I would get in Ollie's pickup truck, his Jeep pickup, that dog rode in the back, but it didn't like anybody else riding in the truck. And every single time, Ollie would yell, "You son of a bitch!" And he'd yell at the dog, and then he'd pick up a stick, and before he could pick up that stick, that dog would bite my shoulder just as I got into the truck. I hated that dog. It was the vilest dog I have ever met in my life. And I like dogs. But I did not like Cole. I did not like that dog at all. But Ollie and I worked together. I remember once Ollie and I had a confrontation. We were loading sand for mixing mortar for the stonework in the foreman's fireplace. And we were throwing shovel. We had two shovels, and one had a very small blade, and then there was a standard size shovel, and I picked up a big shovel, And he said, "No, you use this little one." And I said, "I'm not using any little shovel." And he and I had a face-off right there. I ended up using the little shovel. But that was Ollie. And he didn't have a tooth in his head. And that's why I think he loved coming to Helen Foreman's kitchen. She had before they built the big cabin, she had a big Monarch, still has it, but it's in the newer cabin now that we built. I helped build in 1962. But she would always had a pot of soup on the back of that stove, and anything that was left over got thrown in that pot of stew or soup or whatever it was called. And if somebody showed up, she'd just start throwing water in it until it was enough to go around. But Ollie, I think, liked that because he didn't have to chew anything. And when he'd stop in for dinner, he was pretty clever about showing up. This is after Madge had died. He was pretty clever about showing up at mealtimes. And if there was a piece of meat, Helen or Orville would say, "You want any help with that?" And he'd say, "No, I'll just gum it for a while." That's what he would do. And he rolled his own cigarettes. I thought that was pretty fascinating. I'd never met anybody that rolled their own cigarettes. And he'd just sit there and pull out a bag of Bull Durham and twist them up. This toothless mouth would just gum the cigarette. And I was captivated by it. And when he got thrown off the place after Madge died. And one day he said, "Richard, I need to go up and get my traps. You want to come with me?" And I just thought trapping was the end all, and I had read everything I could about trapping. I'd never trapped anything other than a gopher. And I almost made a big mistake. We loaded the back of his Jeep with traps, beaver traps. I mean, this thing was heaped high with beaver traps, and they were all looked like they were rusty and needed to be polished up. I mean, I couldn't believe that there would be a trap in such bad condition for a guy who was noted up here as a trapper. And as we were unloading those traps, the foreman had given Ollie permission to encouraged him to live at their homestead cabin on Mud Lake, and we were unloading those traps into the barn. And I said, "You want me to oil those?" And he said, "Don't you dare." because the oil would have left human scent on them. Uh-huh. And he liked them. They were all scented up just the way he wanted them. He didn't want any scent of oil on them. Oh, boy, that was almost a big screw-up. So
it sounds like you knew them pretty well. How about some of the other homesteaders?
Well, I knew, as I said, Harry and Lena Holcomb, because the foreman's always checked in with the Holcombs. Orville was always willing to help people with their legal work. He wasn't licensed to practice law in Montana. He was an attorney in Jacksonville, Illinois. And actually was in practice with Mr. Vaught, L.O. Vaught of Mount Vaught in Glacier National Park. Mount Vaught's named after him. And so we would stop in at always and frequently at the Holcombs and have a cup of coffee. And I remember Harry would always say, after Lena poured a cup of coffee, there was sugar on the table, he'd say, if somebody reached for the sugar, he'd say, "Go easy on that, we have to buy that." And because they grew and raised and did it, they were pretty self-sufficient on their homestead. And they were getting on in years when I first arrived, but they were a classic American Gothic. I mean, I could almost see him if I use my imagination, holding a pitchfork. Lena was one of those, had that caricature of, you know, when you have a dried apple, you carve a person's face out on an apple and it dries out. Well, that's the way it was. It was just, and both of them. And Harry had these really thick glasses. He couldn't see very well at all. But he wore these blue bib overalls, and And I just had a nice, slow way of talking, and you could just sit there for hours. Lena, I was thinking about this a little bit. I can just remember once that Orville shows up, and he said, "Lena, I brought you a present." And she just giggled, and she said, "Oh, yeah, what'd you bring me?" He said, I brought you some toilet water." And, you know, this is, you know, eau de cologne, you know, sort of thing, but toilet water. And it was in a vessel that was the shape of a toilet. And he said, "Lena, I want you to have this." And Lena just started to giggle. She just giggled and giggled and giggled, and she just couldn't get over that Orville had brought her some toilet water in a toilet bowl. And that was...
There were really some characters up there.
Oh, there were. I mean, I remember going out. We needed some kerosene. Foreman's needed some kerosene. And so we stopped at Holcomb's and said, "Hey, can I get a gallon of kerosene from you?" And Harry said, "Yeah, there's some out." And it's one of those wooden barn shed structures at the back. And so we went out there. And that's how I learned how to siphon without having to suck the gas or oil or kerosene out of a... He reached over and he grabbed this section of hose, and he stuck the hose down in this 55-gallon drum, and then all the way down, and then just before he pulled the hose out, he put his thumb over it, and he pulled it out real fast, and then tipped it way down, and that created the siphon. And he didn't get a mouthful of kerosene at all. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And I've used one of those kinds of credit cards since. And it really works. The Wurtz would sow in the wintertime. A lot of people would drop off their hides, deer and elk. And they would, if you left them a green hide, they'd give you a pair of gloves that they had made the winter before in exchange. And Orville had a jacket that he had killed an elk, and he took the hide to the Wurtz, and they made him a elk hide jacket out of that. They had to add a little bit, but of somebody else's hide, I suppose, but... They were interesting people. I didn't know them well, but I remember stopping every once in a while on our way through.
So how did the Foremans end up in the North Fork, or how did they end up with a homestead piece?
Yeah, Helen had Mr. Vaught came to Glacier Park before Glacier Park was a park, and to hike and to hunt. He believed, he was an attorney, and he believed that you should be able to get your work done in 10 months of the year and have 2 months to recreate, to vacation. And he came out as a guest of the railroad. And in those days, Mr. Kelly had a homestead at the head of Lake McDonald, and it's since became known as Kelly's Camp. And a buckboard would meet them at the Belton train station and take them up to Sprague Creek on the lake or on up to Kelly's. But that's how Mr. Vaught came to this country. And then he brought his niece, Helen Foreman, Helen Clary, before she married Orville. And so, as a young woman, Helen kind of had walked through this country with her uncle. And then, when she and Orville were married, they came to spend time at Kelly's Camp, but they spent most of their time at Upper Quartz Lake. They would be packed in and spend all summer at Upper Quartz. Then, after the war, Orville was in the Marine Corps in the Pacific, and after the war, they came back to the park and said it's time to start looking around because the park's going to get crowded. And they looked for property and discovered that Ed Peterson had his brothers, his deceased brothers, homestead for sale. And they couldn't afford it, all of it. So Helen and her brother, Ed, split that homestead. And they bought it, the Emil Peterson homestead. And then when Ed Peterson left, had to sell up, and went to, as I understand it, went to the VA home to live out the rest of his days, he offered his homestead to Helen and Orville. He liked the way that they had taken care of it and offered it to them. And that must have been in the early 50s, maybe as late as 54. I don't know exactly when that transaction took place. And so that's how the Foremans came into that piece of property. Mm-hmm. And it's been in their family ever since. And I'm just really lucky that the family, Peggy and Mike, there were three children. The Foremans had three children, Connie, Peggy, and Mike. Peggy was the oldest. They've kept me in the loop. Connie died many years ago. But Peggy and I still carry on quite a conversation, and they've kept me in the loop, and I help manage their property and take care of it when they're not there.
Yeah.
So I'm really, really lucky.
Yes.
With that.
Yes. And you told me that they bought the property for some outrageous amount of money.
Yeah. It 2 years ago, I ran into was contacted by Ed Peterson's grandnephew. And Mellum is his name. What's his first name?
Carl.
Carl Mellum. Just out of the blue, he had made an inquiry on the North Fork, and somebody said, well, talk to Richard Hildner because he knows all about the Foreman property. And Carl came out and brought some old pictures of the of Ed Peterson's homestead. And we got to talking, and he said, well, you might be interested in this letter. And here was a letter that Ed Peterson had written to his family back in Michigan. And Ed was one of three brothers, Ed, Axel, and Emil. And all three of them homesteaded up here, and all three of them were bachelors. But Ed said, I'm going to try and sell Emil's place. The appraiser says one price. He said, I think I can do better than that. I think I can get $10 an acre for it. And as far as I know, that's what he got, was $10 an acre for that piece of property.
Not bad.
No, it would have been a pretty good deal. But, you know, it's funny. So many times you look at a piece of property, you would have, could have, should have, and you say it was worth or sold for such and such. I could have bought it for such and such, and then nobody had any money, and mm-hmm. now nobody has the kind of money it takes to, mm-hmm. to buy a big piece
mm-hmm.
now. So
yeah.
That's kind of the way it is. I also, I should tell you, I got a chance to work for a number of years with a couple of other people that in the summertime. One was Austin Weichert, and Austin Weichert was an early homesteader up here, and his father had guided parties through the Yellowstone, parties of settlers coming through the Yellowstone in the days when they had to still worry about attack from Native Americans. Mm-hmm. But Austin was an artist with an axe. I have never seen anybody wield an axe with such skill and dexterity. I remember when we were building the Foreman's, what they call their new Maine home now, as opposed to the old, the original homestead cabin, which was Old Maine, or is Old Maine, and we needed a beam to fit underneath. We were getting ready to set flooring, and Austin said, how long is it going to take to get a timber brought up from town? And Orville said, well, I can drive to Polebridge and make a telephone call, and we can probably get a truck to bring it up in a couple of days, 2 or 3 days. And Austin said, oh, I don't have that kind of time. And we had some lodgepole pine logs, house logs, out that were decked up. And he got out his log dogs, these angled pieces of steel to hold the log from rolling. got out a chalk line, snapped a chalk line, pulled out his broad axe, and in less than an hour, he had a beautiful hand-hewn beam that's now buried in the bowels of his cabin. Nobody will ever see it. But it was an absolutely, I was in awe. And when he would notch the logs, he had a 3/4 size cruiser's axe. And he had modified that cruiser's axe so that it had a bit of a curve. He had heated it and shaped it somehow, so it had a little bit of a curve, so when he would swing that axe, it would come down and would start to make a scooping motion. Then he'd flip his axe over and slice on the other side. And boom, 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 he had a notch. And then he would flip the log over and see how it fit. He'd rescribe it. It was a piece of spring from a car, a piece of spring steel, a leaf spring, but he had made two little ears on it, sharpened ears, so that he could run it alongside. Once he had the log in place, he could run it alongside the length of the log, and it would score it, it would scribe it, and he could see where he had to dish it out, and then he would make a channel for the log that was coming in to sit on the log that was already in place. And they would fit just as closely as you can put one, your two index fingers, one on top of the other. It was just absolutely beautiful. It required almost no chinking at all.
Wow.
And he just had all kinds of things. And the way we brought up the logs was just like, it was like a mast and a jib and a boom. A mast and a boom. It's a gin pole type thing, and we just bring the logs in and crank it up with a block and tackle and swing them around into place. And the logs went up, and then Walt Hammer built the fireplace. And it's a massive fireplace. I think the heatilator on the living room side is 5 feet across, so it burns big wood. And almost one entire summer, well, when I wasn't fighting Cola, Ollie's dog, we hauled rock for that fireplace, and then I would just mix mortar, and Walt would say more mortar, and I'd go get more. I'd start mixing mortar, and then he'd say I need more rock, and I'd keep a pile of rock in front of him as he worked, and then some. If he didn't like the rocks I'd brought into the building, he'd go out, and we had this huge monster rock pile, and he'd go out and he'd poke around, and then he'd, oh, I like this one, and he didn't say 10 words in a working day, and other than more mortar, and he'd say that 5 times. Well, that was 10 words. That pretty much took care of it. And he was just very laconic and quiet, but he was an artisan as well, and it's just a beautiful fireplace. And it was fun to watch all that come together. I would putter around when I didn't have anything to do. And the next year, after that, the Chrismans were building a cabin, and Walt Hammer did that work. And the Chrismans had asked Walt, I think that's the way it worked, you need a helper. You want Richard Hildner. And he said, yeah, I can work with Richard. I think it's maybe because I kept my mouth shut for once. But Walt and I worked all one summer on Chrisman's cabin. And it was a completely different way of laying up the logs that Walt used. But what was fun was for me was both of those guys, Austin and Walt, sometimes they would just sit with their legs crossed and their arms folded, and they'd just look at the work that they'd done. And they just kind of, they'd get almost trance-like, it seemed to me, as I think about it. And then they'd get up and go to work. They had figured out what they were going to do next. And then they go to work at it. And then pretty soon, sometimes they just sit and have a cup of coffee. That was... Oh, the other thing I remember about Austin liked Helen's Foreman's cooking too. Everybody liked Helen's cooking, but we didn't have any hot or cold running water, so if you wanted hot water, you had to heat it up on the stove. And every day or two or three days, Austin would shave, and I'd never watched anybody shave with a straight razor before. And I was just fascinated. He'd sit there and he'd get out this straight razor and he'd strop it four or five times, and he'd have his face all lathered up, and here was this blade going across his chin, and I thought, oh, he's going to kill himself. And he's going to slice his neck. And so I asked him once, I said, have you ever cut yourself? And he said, I gave myself a pretty good nick once when I swatted a fly when I had the razor in my hand. And I thought, oh, I bet you did. But Austin was, he was just, he was a character. He drove these Hudson Hornets. He had two of them, I think, and one of them was probably just for spare parts, but every once in a while they'd run. And all of his tools were in the back of it. Everything he owned in terms of tools were there. And he had all these just nifty little things that, he'd figure things out.
So as a young person in the North Fork, it sounds like you did a lot of work, but what about social life? Was there any social life up here?
Oh, there was social life. Ruth Saunderson taught me how to square dance at the hall, and I remember that distinctly, and we would come down to the hall. I think the dances, at least in my memory, were much more frequent than they are now, and sometimes there'd be a caller, and sometimes there would be records, but we would have, probably four or five squares going at any one time. And Ruth, I remember she just grabbed me one time. I was wanting to dance, but I didn't know the first thing about it, and I had two left feet. And she just brought me right out there, and she'd swing me around, and she could swing you around. There was no question about it. And I thought that was pretty neat stuff. And people would dance, and then they'd break it about 11 o'clock at night for lunch. And there'd be a big spread out on that big counter, and everybody would eat, and then they'd dance for a little bit longer, and then everybody would just disappear back into the woodwork. And I would sit on those benches next to the Holcombs. The Funks were there. I mean, it was all of these old timers. The Hansons were there. It was a magical time for a 12-year-old kid. 13, 14, 15. I wasn't here the summer I turned 16. I was off in Europe. My father was a college professor and college dean, and he was on a sabbatical, and so I didn't come in 1962. I didn't come, but every summer then until I started smoke jumping in 1967. So I was here till then, but it's always been a place of the heart. Uh-huh. Those were the social activities. 4th of July was a big deal. There was no parade, but there was sometimes a big picnic down at the Saunderson Airstrip. Lloyd and Ruth, when I first met them, had Ray Hart talks about the old Top Hat House. That's where they had their logging business. That was the business end of the operation. And they... Ruth's dad, Charlie Durdle, was an interesting character. And Charlie had made his his livelihood moving grain elevators. Now think about what it's like to move a wooden, however many story grain elevator from one place to another. But that was quite a skill, because we raised two of the original homestead cabins at the Foreman property and put new rounds of logs underneath them. And Charlie was the main push on raising those buildings. But I remember Charlie at the Foreman's lake cabin. We had the floor all ripped out, and so you were having to climb over the stringers and log stringers, and we were headed towards the door, and he was a crusty kind of a guy, and I was 12 years old, and I had been taught to respect my elders, And we both got to the door at the same time, and I said, "Go ahead, sir." And he looked at me with fire in his eyes, and he said, "How would you like to be called a gourd head?" And I just shriveled and shrank. I said, I didn't call you a gourd head." And he just burst into laughter. And from then on, he called me gourd head. And so I was always known as gourd head. But he was a trickster. And I had dinner once at Saunderson's. Yeah, they had invited me to stay. And he said, we ate family style and just like you did in a logging camp. And here was all this food on the table. And there was this big thing of mashed potatoes right in front of me. And Charlie must have known that, because he said, "Here, hand me that," whatever it was. And just as I handed it to him, he said, "Oh," and like he was going to drop it. And of course, I dropped my hand, the back of my hand, right into that plate, that bowl of mashed potatoes. And he just howled. He just thought that was the funniest thing, that I had stuck my hand in the mashed potatoes. But the corner cabinet and the foreman's cabin, Charlie made that for them, just as a gift.
And it's still there.
And it's still there. Yeah, it's their little china cabinet that's in the corner.
That's great.
And I knew Ralph there.
Oh, you did?
I had, when I was working for the Chrisman's, they needed to build a new road that kind of comes in across in the front of Larry Wilson's place, and they needed to know where those lines were. And Ralph Thayer had run most of the lines in this country, and his survey is the legal survey. And he said one day, "I need a stick man." And I didn't know what a stick man was, but I quickly learned what the stick man was. He would set up his staff compass, and I would walk out with a metal chain, and we would chain off, and then he'd say stick, and I had these pins, and when it lined up just the way he wanted it, he'd say stick, and I'd yell stuck. And that meant that the marker had, and then we'd measure how many lengths of chain we had taken out, or whether or not we went a full chain. And pretty soon we got to a corner, and he said, "Well, here's a corner." And I said, "Okay." And he said, what's your initials?" And I said, "R.H., Richard Hildner." He said, "You don't have a middle name?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it's Smith." And he said, "Well, then that's what we put on the corner. We put R.S.H. And so somewhere out there is probably a R.L.T. for Ralph L. Thayer and an R.S.H. for Richard Smith Hildner. And I've since found some corners on the Foreman property that were run by Ralph Thayer. He did the survey when Foreman's bought that property. And his helper then was Harry Holcomb. And so, but Harry must not have had a middle name, because you see RLT and HH for Harry Holcomb when you find those corners. And of course, Ralph was bald as a cue ball. And he had this, I want to say pinched countenance. But he just had a twinkle in his blue eyes that was infectious, and he was a slim, trim fellow even in his 80s, and could still get through the trees and through the timber and through the woods. Just an amazing feat to watch him go along. And a story that he's told, and he told to me, was the time that he was cruising timber and he stepped over a pile of logs, and the pile of logs moved, and he realized it wasn't a log but a grizzly bear that he'd just stepped on. And at which point he shinnied up a tree. He dropped his axe and shinnied up a tree, and the bear shook the tree, and he realized that there was going to be a confrontation between the two of them. And so Ralph shinnied down the tree, and the bear, meantime, I think, had chewed on his foot. So things weren't going well for Ralph, and he picked up his axe, and he smacked that bear with the flat side of his axe right across the nose. And the bear turned tail and ran away. And then and Ralph walked out. And Ralph walked with a limp, but not because of that. The reason he walked with a limp is he was coming up from town in the winter on the logging truck going down past him, and he got too far to the edge and he went down off of a snowbank and spent the night wrecked in his car, and he'd broken his leg. And it wasn't until the next day that he was able to crawl back up to the edge of the road. And I think it was that that broken leg that caused him to walk with a little bit of a limp. He married a gal when he was in his 80s, and she was maybe late 80s. I think that was probably the last chivalry that was ever held on the North Fork. And I don't know if you know what a chivalry is, but when folks get married and got married up here, all the neighbors would turn out in the dark, and they'd surround the person's cabin with pots and pans and wooden spoons, and they'd bang on it, and they'd dance all the way around the cabin, and they'd bang on the pots and pans. And when Ralph got remarried, they had a big chivalry for him. I don't remember his wife's name. After the Red Bench fire, I came up and visited with Ruth, and because I'd been on the Red Bench fire, and I suppose that's a story for another day. But I asked Ruth about wintertime and her and Lloyd's logging operation. And she told me a story about, I think they must have been up Whale Creek, and they had their operation. They didn't usually, I don't remember them ever hauling logs out, but they sawed timbers or logs into boards, and they hauled boards out. And they had a mill, I think it must have been up Whale Creek, and in the 50s. And they'd been up all winter long, Lloyd and Ruth and Jack Matheson, and maybe Noni was there too, Jack's wife. And they were running real low on diesel, and they knew that they were going to have to come out and get some more diesel, but the only way to get out was they had a sled, a big sled, that they hooked on behind their D9 tractor, bulldozer, and with some cables, and then they put the empty barrels on the sled, but one barrel still had diesel in it, so they could keep refilling the cat as they came down the road. And they slid these barrels on the sled all the way out the Whale Creek Road down to Pole Bridge, and Jack Matheson led in front with a rifle in case they encountered a moose stuck in the road and they would have to dispatch the moose. But it's just the fact that they had to sled all that, those empty diesel barrels out there, and somebody riding a shotgun. It just seemed to, but it was quite a story. And Ruth not only kept the books, but she also, she drove the logging truck. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's a figment of my imagination or what, but I somehow recall that there was no door on their logging truck on the driver's side. And I asked Ruth about that once, and she said, oh, that's just so I can jump out if I lose control. And I don't know if that was true or that's just something that's in my imagination. And fishing was pretty good. And there was, it was a 10 fish limit on the North Fork. And once I got better at it, Orville and I would go fishing, or whoever was staying at the foreman's place, and we'd go and we'd catch some fish and bring some up from the river for breakfast, and Orville would fry up bacon and make his homemade pancakes and fry up the fish, and we'd have fish and pancakes and bacon for breakfast. And it just didn't get better than that.
Oh, it sounds great.
And Helen would bake on the wood stove about once a week. And so there was this smell of fresh baked bread, and she made these cinnamon rolls that were to die for. I have that recipe. Her daughter Peggy sent it to me. And because she had gotten the recipe from the cook at Yellow Bay, the research station on Flathead Lake at Yellow Bay. And it makes 80 cinnamon rolls, so it makes a lot.
Wow, 80. You'd have to invite everybody in the North Fork over.
Yeah, it was.
So you mentioned the Red Bench Fire. Tell me about the Red Bench Fire.
Well, the Red Bench Fire was probably one of the biggest fires at that time that most people could remember. And it started September 6, 1988. And I was working for the Forest Service. Well, let me back up a little bit on my career, I suppose. I worked in 1965 for the old Coram Ranger District, which has since been incorporated into the Hungry Horse Ranger District, as a fire guard. And then in 1966, the summer of 1966, I applied to be a smoke jumper. And as luck would have it, I didn't get that job, because I was nowhere near prepared for that. They offered me a job on the hotshot crew at Big Creek. And so that was the first year that the hotshot crew was at Big Creek, and I worked for the Forest Service then. Through that season, Bruce Piles was the AKA Bloody. That was an inside joke of his, but the next year I did go to work as a smoke jumper, and then I spent 2 years in South America in the Peace Corps doing firework, and then I came back and was picked up again by the Forest Service and worked full-time for the Forest Service for about 17 years. Then when I quit, moved to the Flathead, and that got me back into the North Fork. And one of the guys that I had been on a national overhead team with was the district ranger at Glacier View, Tom Hope. And he hired me to work on environmental documents and to substitute to be the aerial observer when they would fly air patrol during the fire season. And so it was that summer of 1988 that I was happened to be, we took off early in the morning. I think Mike Strand Aviation had the contract to fly the air patrol, and so Mr. Strand and I took off, and we were going to fly over the Bob Marshall to check on a fire that was out or in mop-up stage, because there was a red flag warning for extremely high winds. And as we started up over the Swan Range, I noticed that Mike cinched down his shoulder straps and his waist strap in the airplane. And we started to bounce around, and I quickly followed suit. And no matter how strapped down we were, I just remember we were bouncing around so much that my head kept hitting the roof, the headliner of the airplane. And he, as we started up over the Swan range, he said, "This is not going to be fun today." And it really wasn't fun at all. We bounced around and checked out the fire, and everything looked good. And we came back and landed at City Airport. And I went back that's when the Forest Supervisor's office was across from City Airport in Kalispell. And I walked over to the dispatch just to give them the rundown and talk about what we'd seen. And just as I walked in, I heard a report of a smoke on the Red Bench. Timber sale, or in that vicinity, and I knew where that was, and I just turned to the dispatcher and I said, "We're on our way. I'll check in when we're airborne." And we came up over that afternoon. Mike Strand and I came up over. We could see by the time we cleared City Airport and were over Columbia Falls, we could already see some smoke coming up in the vicinity of Red Bench. And it was probably maybe only a quarter of an acre in size when we started to circle it. But it was just explosive. I've never seen fire behavior, and that's what I did for the Forest Service on an overhead team. I was a fire behavior analyst. I had never seen such extreme fire behavior, and this thing quickly started to take on a life of its own, and we just circled and circled and circled, and this fire went from a quarter of an acre to a half of an acre to an acre, and just got bigger and bigger, and it just started to pulse. It started to undulate like a jellyfish, only it was a red jellyfish that just, and then all of a sudden it just lifted itself out of the woods, out of the trees, like a basketball, like a big huge orange basketball. It just came up out of the, in this column of smoke, and the wind caught it, and the basketball of fire just about a quarter of a mile downwind just dropped, and when it dropped it exploded, and then there was 5 acres, and this thing started to pulse, and it pulsed and it pulsed, and it glowed like a huge cauliflower, and it just got bigger and bigger, and then all of a sudden just lifted up this basketball one more time, and then it went, and it exploded in fire, and it just continued to bounce its way down Red Meadow, and by then it was starting to get dark, and we were not supposed to fly in the dark, and so Mike Strand said, we need to get back to the airport, and we got back to the airport in the dark, but we didn't tell him. I mean, I logged us out while it was still daylight, but then we landed in the dark, and then I got in a truck, came up to Glacier View, and I came up the North Fork Road and checked in with some of the folks, Tom Hope, and I was by myself, and I drove across the Red Meadow Bridge, and I got up to Vic Tashney's old place. The Barnes, I think, have that place just north, up road from that. And I turned around in Vic Tashney's, and Vic was an old homesteader. He homesteaded here in 1919. And I knew Vic Tashney as well. But I turned around in his driveway, and I stopped there for a minute. There'd been a fire crew with an engine crew spraying water on the building. And they left. And as I turned around, I said to myself, well, I'm looking at this for the last time. It won't be here in the morning. And I could see the fire coming down the Red Meadow drainage. And as I turned around, everybody else who had been up river of up road of the fire was stopped on the bridge. And I was last in line of this parade. And I thought, this is not where I want to be. I don't want to be last in line. I would rather be first in line. So eventually, everybody moved on just as the fire got to the Red Meadow Bridge, and we beat feet out and got back down to Pole Bridge. And fire took the next part of the next day to get to Pole Bridge, and I don't know, somewhere along the way I grabbed a little bit of sleep, but when the fire got to Pole Bridge, there was an overhead team had been ordered. But I was at Pole Bridge when the fire came over the top of Pole Bridge. And what I had done was, it used to be that you could make a loop from Pole Bridge over to the Pole Bridge and then come north under Vance Hill back out to the North Fork Road. You could make that loop. And the fire hadn't quite gotten there yet. It still hadn't come down on the backside of Vance Hill. And I came around and I said to Tom Hope, who was, as I said, the district ranger, I said, Tom, and he and I had worked a lot of fire together. I said, Tom, we can maybe slow it down if we can backfire from that far road. And he said, well, let's give it a try. And I said, he asked me, he said, does that road go through? And I said, yeah, I just drove it. I know we can get through. So we loaded up some drip torches mixed with gasoline and diesel, and we started over by the Pole Bridge, and we started up that road, and we got as close to the fire as we could. Sometimes we were just driving alongside the road, and he would drive and I would hang on the tailgate of the pickup truck, hanging on, you know, standing on the bumper, almost as fast as he could drive. But I mean, he could idle along, and I was running a string of fire And then we get to somebody's cabin, and sometimes the cabins were already engulfed because they'd stacked their firewood against the walls of the cabin, and once that, we just couldn't do anything about it. But the ones, we saved several cabins by just running a string of fire from their drive, for example, around so it would back in, because the fire was sucking into and taking our backfire. And we topped out back at the North Fork Road just as the fire hit the bottom of Vance Hill. And we made it back to Pole Bridge. And I think it took a little bit of the snooze out of the fire. It slowed it down a little bit, but certainly didn't stop it. And Tom said, well, Richard, you're in charge. And I said, thanks. He said, I've got to go to a meeting. The overhead team is going to form up at the fire camp. They're going to put in at Moran Creek. And he said, you're here. So I said, okay. And I remember the last of the residents, and I wish I knew who this person was, but somebody pulled out and they had a mattress in the back of their truck, and they looked at me and they said, will we be back? And I said, yes, you'll be back. Don't worry, you're going to be back. I don't know what you're going to come back to, but you'll be back. And by then there were just 12 of us left at Pole Bridge. There was a Forest Service crew with 3,000 gallons and a water cannon mounted on the top of this truck. John Frederick and then somebody with John had decided to stay in. They were going to evacuate in place. And I quickly showed John how to use a fire shelter. I said, here, take this. If the place burns down, go out in the meadow where the old hockey rink is and open it up and climb in and stay put. He said, okay. And the Forest Service crew was running around, driving that truck from cabin to cabin, shooting water on the cabins in the town site. And the county road crew, with about, there was probably 3,000 gallons in each one of their trucks. They had these pumper trucks, tankers. And they had backed them into the against the gasoline pump by the north, between the Northern Lights and the Merck, and we had run some hose out, and these guys had never been on a forest fire before, and here's this wall of smoke and ash and fire coming right towards us. And they said, now you'll tell us when it's time to go, won't you? And I said, yep, count on me. I'll tell you when to go, when we're leaving, when we're pulling out, we're just gonna go. And so, meanwhile, they were spraying water on the Northern Lights, and as they were spraying water on the Northern Lights, embers were falling on their shirts. They didn't have fire shirts, and one guy was patting out the fires that would start on the other guy's back, you know, as their shirts would catch on fire. Not flaming, but just smoldering. And so it was kind of harum scarum there. And then all of a sudden, they didn't have any water, and I was busy going back and forth in as many places as I could get to and keep circling around. And the pumps had stopped, and I, what's going on? And here were these road crew guys from the county trying to start the gas pump at the Merck because the pumps had run out of gas. And I said, I've already turned off the propane. And it's a propane generator. We can't make this gas pump work. I said, do you have any gas in your trucks? And they said, oh yeah, we've got 5 gallons in the truck. So I ran over to the road crew truck and picked up a 5-gallon jerry can, and these two trucks were parked parallel, side by side, and with, oh, maybe 2-3 feet between them. And here I was, along with this couple guys from the road crew, we were pouring gasoline into these trucks as these embers are rolling around in this vortex between the two trucks. And I was thinking, this is not the smartest thing I've ever done. And but obviously we didn't explode. We got the lids back on it. I carried the gas back over. We got the pumps started, and we started spraying the Northern Lights. And then all of a sudden I could see that the meadow in front of the Northern Lights was about to catch on fire. And so I jumped in the road crew pickup truck, and I drove it into the meadow in front of the Merck. And And then I just sat there, and as soon as that meadow exploded in fire and started to burn down, the one in front of the Merc started to burn down, or caught on fire, and then I moved the truck over to the burned out meadow. And one of those guys on the road crew said, "Now, Richard, when is it we're supposed to go?" And I said, "That was a half an hour ago. We're not going anyplace. We're here for the duration." And they said, "Oh." And so we just stayed with it. And finally, that road cleared, and you could get back in. And about that time, the new fire boss from the overhead team came in, and just as he pulled in, and there wasn't anything we could do about the old barn, the old hay barn behind the Merc. It's just too porous and the too much hay in there, and it just burned to the ground. And it was this glowing skeleton. It had a life of its own because it was on fire from the inside, not the outside. Mm-hmm. And there was another building. I don't remember who. It was the phony preacher that had the cabin he burned it down anyway afterwards. But I don't know if you know the story about the phony preacher, but somebody else can tell that story. They had a tent revival going on in the big meadow just below Polebridge. He was a snake oil salesman, and he took people for a ride. But anyway, I remember that Tom Hope and I, we could see the fire was approaching this one cabin, and I had a backpack pump on, and we had a drip torch so that we could fire off around the cabin. And what we did was we would hide from the fire behind the cabin, and then we'd run out and we'd spray a little bit of water, and we'd light a little bit of fire, and we protected all the way around this cabin. And then the fire went past us, and I can remember flames beating against the logs, and the logs withstanding that kind of heat, and we saved that cabin. And then that guy burned it down maybe a year later. He was wacko, but he was wanted in Texas. Anyway, he talked some people out of money for Bibles and hymnals and things. So that's my Red Bench story.
Wow, you were right in the middle of it.
It was interesting.
Yeah. So when did you buy this place that you have on Moose Creek Road?
Actually, Suzanne bought this place. My wife Suzanne bought this place before we met, and the night of our first date in Whitefish, we went back to her house and sat and drank tea and started telling each other North Fork stories, and we soon discovered that we had a mutual love of the North Fork. And Suzanne said, "You want to come see my cabin?" And I said, "I'd love to see your cabin. Do you want to see the cabin I take care of?" And she said, "I'd love to see the cabins you take care of." And we've been here ever since. And we both just enjoy putzing around the place and doing things.
That's great. You have great stories, Richard.
Oh, not really. I the tape doesn't show me grinning, I don't suppose, but I...
You can probably hear it in your voice.
I've, over the years, seen an awful lot of people come and go. Many people fall in love with the idea of the North Fork, but it's much rarer those who make it a place of the heart. But once it becomes a place of the heart, there is no turning back. There is no place that people come back to. I was reading an article in Orion magazine just a week or so ago, and it was... There were a bunch of vignettes about where you live, and they were also saying, feel free to submit your article or your essay on where you live And I said to Suzanne, I said, I've come up with the first line. It's, this is where I live, but it's not where I reside. Because this is where I live. We reside in Whitefish, but we live on the North Fork. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's the way it's become. And it's just, yeah. It's just a wonderful place.
Yeah. It's great. So, anything else that we've...
How long have we been talking?
I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah, I've been completely mesmerized by your stories.
Oh, gosh.
But, yeah, this is good. I didn't get to ask you about any close encounters with animals.
I've never had any really close encounters. And what's amazing to me is, from time to time, when I worked, I lived at the Foreman's, but I was working for Chrisman's, and I would cross country from, because it was almost faster to walk it than to drive it, not quite, but I would walk to work from Foreman's cross country down to near what's the old Kintler Ranch, the Monahan place, which is the place that the Chrisman's bought from Bart Monahan, who was the homesteader. And I never thought once about bear encounters. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty bear-y country. But I would fish and walk around them and not pay any attention. It was long before the invention of bear spray. Mm-hmm. I never had those encounters with bears. In fact, I never really ran into grizzly bears until I met Suzanne, she said I was better than bear spray because we weren't seeing bears, but this summer's been a big summer for bears. Uh-huh. For us.
Uh-huh. So you've been coming to the North Fork for a long, long time, and what kind of changes have you seen over the years?
I've seen, of course, 1972, when the pine beetles first appeared, about 1971, 72. The North Fork, the stands of open stands of very mature, nice, big, tall, straight, 10-inch diameter and better lodgepole pine. Those stands are pretty much gone. You can still see some around a few, but that was one. The road was narrow and rough. They used to oil it, and so you wanted to make sure that you weren't driving the road right after they oiled it, because you never get the oil off the car. I was just thinking about the gas pump at the Merck. As I said, Ted Ross and his wife had the Merck. And if you needed gas, and I suspect it's the same gas pump that's tucked in the corner at the Northern Lights outside, but it was one of those hand pumps. You just pushed and pulled this hand pump, and it would fill this glass globe with 10 gallons of gasoline, and then gravity would drain it back out into your car. And you walked into the Merck and said, I got about 9.5 gallons, or 9 gallons, or 10 gallons, whatever it marked on this glass globe. And once a month, they paid your tab at the Merck. And they kept, they had little pigeonholes, and they kept a tab for everybody. And the reason they switched is the gas tank leaked into the basement of the Merck. And it's lucky it didn't blow the place up and burn it down. But when that happened, they dug it up, and that was the end of that gas pump, the non-electric gas pump. It was, going to town was an adventure. We didn't do it often. I remember, because at my house, we never had a candy bar. I don't remember my parents ever buying me a candy bar. And when we came out and we'd have a 1 week's shopping that got done to get us settled in. And then we'd go do the big shop. And again, Helen would take out the three-ring binder, and we'd go through the lists and do all the things in inventories and what we needed, more pump parts and parts for this and parts for that, and generator, and you name it, and we had to have one thing after another. And so it was a major expedition. Sometimes it required us to stay overnight. And when we had to stay overnight, we stayed at the Miller's house. Chuck Miller and Margaret. Chuck and Margaret Miller. And her maiden name was Liebig. And Margaret's father was one of the first rangers in the park, and Mount Liebig, just to the south of Great Northern, it's Great Northern, Grant, and then Liebig, that's named after him. And so sometimes we'd stay at the Liebig's house if it was going to be an overnight, because we can get everything done. But we'd get up early in the morning, major expedition to town, and we came to town and we'd start pushing the carts, and we'd go through and we'd have this stack of grocery carts, three grocery carts full of things. And I remember Orville saying, what kind of candy bars do you, candy bars do I like? I've never, do you like Heath bars? Never had a Heath bar. Yeah, you'll mind like a Heath bar. And they'd buy a whole box of them. And I remember that the groceries came to $100. And I thought, oh, that's all the money in the world. $100 worth of groceries. I've never seen $100 worth of groceries before in my life. And then we'd bundle them all up and bring them back and hang that bacon in a sack. And the milk stayed down in the root cellar until it spoiled. And then when it spoiled, I remember once coming up, Helen said, go down to the root cellar. And you had to climb down a ladder down to the root cellar. And she said, bring me up the milk. And I brought the milk up, and it was chunky. And I said, yeah, it's spoiled. It just fell. She said, that's okay. We'll make cottage cheese. And then she'd turn it into cottage cheese. She didn't waste much. So,
it was. So there have been a lot of changes up here.
Been a lot of changes. I mean, the idea that, I mean, the foreman's had early on put in a 32-volt generator. And that was enough to run some reading lights. And then they had a bank of glass storage batteries. I don't know how many there were, but it was lots of them. And so they could run all their reading lights off of those batteries. And that 32-volt generator was enough to run the motor on the agitator washing machine. So when laundry day came, it was a big deal, because everything that could hold water was put on the wood stove and to get hot water. And then we'd hang laundry out to dry. And for showers, it was an open air shower. It was a 32-gallon old steel tank that was painted black. The theory was that by being painted black, it would warm up enough during the day that you could take a shower, and that if it was a cloudy day, you didn't sweat enough, so you didn't have to take a shower anyway. That was the theory. And so showers were few and far between, but if there was going to be a dance at the hall, then you showered. And sometimes the best you could do was a sponge bath, but you cleaned up. And I always wanted to look good, so I put the irons on the stove and heat up the irons, and you to iron with a cast iron iron. Set up the ironing board, and there was a square made out of a piece of blue jeans, padded, kind of like a hot pad. And you'd lift the stove, the iron off the stove, and then you'd hit it on that to make sure it was clean before you started to iron your clothes. And you'd sometimes spit on the bottom of the iron to see if it bubbled, and that way you knew it was hot enough. And I always liked to have my snap shirts, Western shirt. I had two of them, I think, maybe only one. But I was going dancing, and by golly, I wanted to have an iron shirt, and I was indulged with that. But that, speaking of that snap shirt, reminds me that at the end of my first summer, I came back. I was going to be a seventh grader, and school had already been in session for a week, and my parents had already been to get my school supplies. But so everybody already had friends, and I wanted to, by then I'd met Lloyd Saunderson, and I wanted to be somewhere between a logger and a trapper, and I wasn't sure which. I was conflicted. And so I showed up in seventh grade with my paper sack full of school supplies. What a dork. And school supplies. And I was wearing my logger boots and my blue jeans and my flannel shirt. It was August. Or early September in Illinois, nobody wore a flannel shirt in August or September in Illinois. And I'm sure my classmates looked at me like, who is this guy? And I told them, I've just been in the woods in Montana, and I've been fishing and trapping gophers. And they looked at me like I was from Mars. And my situation didn't get better the whole year. I was just kind of a misfit, and that didn't help my academics at all, and I went from being in the group of kids that were college bound to the group of kids that were headed the other direction, but I still had my Montana roots by then. Oh gosh,
you knew where your heart was.
I did, yeah. So that's my North Fork.
That's
I probably
great.
Bored everybody to tears.
No,
with
you
this.
Did not bore anybody, and thank you so much for this interview on behalf of the North Fork History Project. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks to you. I know we didn't have much eye contact. I was just kind of looking out the window and letting my eyes glass over and. I worry a little bit that I'm only 66 and that you'd think I was old enough to remember a story or two. I figure it's the old folks that tell stories. I'm not there yet.
Nope, you're not there yet. You got a long way to go.